Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Alice Walker is our guest this hour. A new book has just been released, The World Has Changed, Conversations with Alice Walker. And these are a series of fascinating, I'm sure she must find them fascinating to read as well, because they're conversations and interviews with Walker from back in 1973 to 2009. So it gives her thoughts about all kinds of issues of writing and poverty and violence and witnessing. I think we'll start the interview talking about witnessing, her reflections on Barack Obama as president. We will certainly talk about that, about raising chickens. The last time we spoke with Alice Walker, she painted this beautiful vision of raising chickens and raising a lot of her own food. She has decided that she, I believe, recently made her decision that instead of having all the materials, the vast collection that she has that is her body of work, that it's going to be in one place now. I believe she decided that it would be at Emory University, and so we'll talk about that decision as well. Alice Walker is our guest. The World Has Changed, Conversations with Alice Walker is the title of the book, and here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email to Alice Walker, you can do that as well, and that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Alice Walker, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
This must have been fun for you to read, to go back in time and read what you were thinking from 1973 all the way through 2009.
Yeah, it was.
Did you find anything remarkable that you looked at it and said, oh, yeah, I remember that part of my life. I had forgotten about that.
Or, well, you know, if you live your life fully, you do forget most of it. And then you kind of think, oh, life today is the life that I have, and that's the one I'm concentrating on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely way of looking back and sitting and looking at some of the things, the issues that I was involved in, and still am to some degree.
Why don't we start with witnessing? I was so struck by some of the events that you've seen, and some of them have been horrible events, murders and those images that you have kept with you. You've been a witness to something, and then you've brought it forward in one of your many pieces of writing. That's quite something, isn't it, to hold on to a person and have that person live again, in a sense.
Well, I didn't actually witness the murders myself. The first instance of violence, and also I want to start by reminding everyone that I'm not really focused just on, you know, death and murder and destruction.
Oh, not at all.
I love the earth, the planet, this, you know, all of the beauty that we have every day. But in any case, when I was 13, my sister, who was working as a cosmetologist in a funeral home, invited me to come and witness the body of a woman who had been shot to death by her husband. She had been shot in the face, and I remember very much being concerned because she was obviously really poor. She was, one shoe was still on her foot, and it had a hole in it, and she had patched this hole with newspaper. And so I was a classmate of her daughter, Kate. And they also had the same last name, Walker. So I think as a 13-year-old, this made a huge impression. And I realized that because she was poor, because she was black in the segregated South, you know, this was a death. I don't think they even did very much to her husband for doing this, that she would never be memorialized, remembered, honored. And I didn't know how to do it, but I went to school, you know, kept going to school, and trained myself to be a writer so that I could memorialize this woman properly. And so many, many years later, I was able to write The Third Life of Grange Copeland, in which her murder is a turning point in the book.
Yeah, what an important thing to be able to do. And you certainly are a witness in many other ways now in your life. You're an international witness to many of our current events.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's the same violence, and that's what's so tragic, that we don't seem to be improving all that much, and it may look different if it's happening in Palestine, but actually it's the same kind of dishonoring of life, and so many women, for instance, poor women in Iraq and Afghanistan and Palestine and elsewhere, are just obliterated. They're just, you know, and nobody ever thinks about them as human beings struggling to make a life on this planet. They're just wiped out, and there is no record unless you happen to see a glimpse, you know, of a pile of bodies somewhere. But these are real people, just as real as, you know, everybody, as us.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but the writers... role can be that. It can be that of witness, and we see that in writers like Victor Hugo and Charles Dickens and, you know, to some extent, Virginia Woolf and Richard Wright and Langston Hughes and, you know, on and on. And it makes the role of writer something that I think is really quite honorable.
Oh, it sure is. There's one of the interviews, I can't remember which one, in which you're talking about characters' names, and you mentioned Charles Dickens, actually, that he really had some luscious names for many of his characters. I never thought about that, but it's so true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, he gave a lot of thought to that, because the name had to carry some of their characteristics, and like Mr. Duffy, you know, I mean, you instantly get a Mr. Duffy, and when you see the character that they chose to portray him on in Bleak House, there's a wonderful DVD of Bleak House. You see that they found someone who could do his mouth in the shape you would need to look like a fish and to look like a Mr. Duffy.
Did you have fun with that, with all the writing that you've done? Do you labor, or did those names just sort of pop into your mind?
Well, you know, nothing really pops exactly. It's more like, what is the right thing always? You know, whether it's naming or dressing or thinking or going somewhere, what is the absolutely right thing that fits, just fits, not too much, not too little? And if you wait, the part there that is important is the waiting, just to have the patience to accept nothing short of what is absolutely perfect for what you're doing.
And that's true for everything, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That we think about the right thing. I love that phrase. It's a simple one, but do the right thing.
Well, but it's not so simple as just doing the right thing, because you have to wait until you know what it is. And that's where, as a culture, we fall way short, because we are an impatient culture, and we have a hard time waiting.
And we become more impatient with the advancement of technology, don't we, that everything becomes so incredibly instantaneous. I'm wondering what that does to us.
It makes us crazy.
Right.
The culture is very thin. It's a very thin culture, and it's not, it lacks real soul. And it's tragic. You know, I think if people truly understood that they have to be slower in order to actually be present, it would help our culture a lot. And we're responsible to, you know, for the way technology takes us over. You know, we may not be responsible for actually creating it, but we're definitely responsible for the way we let it just consume us and direct us and really rid us of a lot of our own sort of moral intelligence.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in the whole process that you use. Somebody asked you about how long it takes you to do a novel, an essay, et cetera, and you had different answers for all of that. But I love this idea of going someplace, and you go to a couple places, maybe you go to more than that now, and block out a whole stretch of time, usually a year or sometimes 2 years, to work on your next novel. That it's a process that's not furiously typing away day by day, let's get this done in 60 minutes. It's a longer process.
Well, there again, if you want to offer your best, you know, why wouldn't you? You need time. And so in the early days, this was really a challenge, because I had very little money, and, you know, I was a single mother for part of the time. And I had to do a lot of teaching and speaking and travel. So I had to really consider how I could find a year that would permit me to write a novel. For instance, The Color Purple took exactly a year.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how I would afford, you know, longer than a year. I had a Guggenheim, which was $13,000, and I had $300 a month from Ms. Magazine because I had been an editor there, but I had left. And so they gave me a retainer of $300 a month. So that's all I had. And so I, long story, but, you know, got a divorce, left New York, came to a little place eventually called Boonville, and rented a place for $300 a month and settled down and started writing this novel and finished it. And I was thinking that all that they were growing at the time in Boonville, you know, selling was apples. You could buy a lot of apples, so I started thinking, well, maybe I can somehow get into the apple trade. But, but lucky for me, I didn't quite have to do that.
And tell me how the chickens, I can't remember what part of the world you were in, where all of a sudden you saw chickens in front of you and it brought back a flood of memories, and it was a very important, I can't place where you were.
Okay, it was in Bali.
It was in Bali, right.
I was in Bali. This was in the 80s. I was actually hiding out from severe criticism in this country about The Color Purple, so I went to Bali, which was just heaven. And I was walking home from a fire dance one evening, and my daughter and my partner and myself, and there was a mother hen and her chicks crossing the path, and it was as if I had never seen a chicken. I was transfixed. I just couldn't believe the beauty of this being and the motherliness of her attentiveness to her children. And her regal being, it was just amazing to me. So I didn't know quite what it meant. I thought at the time that it meant that, you know, I was struggling then as now with my vegetarianism. So I thought, oh, I'm being given this message, you know. And I went home and I worked with this, you know, through many years and even decades until I realized that part of what needed to happen was I needed to get some chickens and raise them and reestablish my connection with them as beings, and that this connection had been broken when, as a child, we had had chickens, but, of course, we had to eat them all.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Alice Walker is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The book that has just been released, The World Has Changed, Conversations with Alice Walker. And these are a series of conversations with some darn good interviewers from 1973 all the way through 2009. Literary scholars conducted many of these interviews. We welcome your phone calls for Alice Walker again, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Alice Walker is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. She is, of course, quite a writer. She's known for her literary fiction, including the Pulitzer Prize winning The Color Purple, many volumes of poetry. She is a poet first, and her powerful nonfiction collections. She has worked for the dispossessed all over the world, and we're happy to welcome phone calls for her, 800-486-8655. Let's start some phone calls. Stephanie is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I just wanted to say that The Color Purple was one of my favorite books ever, and also one of my favorite movies. And I was wondering how Alice felt about the interpretation of her book into the film, because often it's not as good.
Well, I wrote a book called The Same River Twice, which answered all the questions that people had been asking me for about 10 years. And so I don't really talk about The Color Purple in that way anymore.
The Same River Twice?
Mm-hmm. Honoring the Difficult.
Honoring the difficult. Okay. She'll send you to another book. I know that you fairly recently, I can't remember how recently, did the recording for The Color Purple, didn't you? You did it.
I did it just 3 months ago.
Oh.
25 years. And just, I just decided finally that I had time and I had space. And that I wanted to render the voices in the way that I thought would be appropriate to the characters, and I couldn't really entrust that to anybody else because nobody would know really those voices. So I did that, and that was the final, I hope, incarnation for my participation.
And you did it with a bad cold.
I had a horrible cold.
Ooh.
But it was fine because what happened was it took 4 days and 4 hours a day, and I just recorded between coughs.
Recorded between coughs.
Calling on the ancestors every moment, and they were wonderful, as always. They said, oh, we can do this.
Thanks, Stephanie, very much for the call. Barbara from Madison. Hello, Barbara.
Hi. It's a real pleasure to be on the phone and I'm speaking with Alice Walker. I'm just finishing the reading of your book. Now is the time to open your heart. And I'm just at the last chapter. And I thought, this is what a great opportunity here. And I wanted to ask you, this book is so different from your the earlier one that I read, you know, The Color Purple and a couple after that. But I was wondering if it represented a total change in your life or just the style of writing that you changed?
Well, I've written 30 books, and they're all pretty different. And I think it's just that as people change and grow and as their interests evolve, they write different books. I think that there are many people who think of The Color Purple as kind of the book for them, and that's fine. But for me, it was a way to commemorate ancestors and my parents and grandparents. So it's about their time. It's not so much about my time. I knew them when I was small. I spent 6 months with my grandparents when I was 8. And so a lot of The Color Purple comes from that period. You know, it was long ago. But the other novels, especially novels starting with The Temple of My Familiar, Possessing the Secret of Joy, Now is the Time to Open Your Heart, By the Light of My Father's Smile, all of those are, you know, they're just about the world and life. And also what's interesting to me, because I travel a lot and I actually live part of the time in Mexico, what's interesting to me is how, you know, the cultures in the world today, more than ever, interact and influence each other. And so I think in this book that you're reading, there is, you know, there are people living in Hawaii, where I also live some of the time, and there are people, you know, in different places. And we're all, in some ways, living the same kinds of life, which is, you know, for many of us, about the planet. You know, it's about not so much about your own little community, even though we love our little communities. But it really is about the whole planet, and we all see that. We can see the whole planet now in a way that we couldn't before.
And I know in the book you named the main character after your grandmother, you said. And I was wondering if this is a fantasy vision you have of your grandmother, or if she was that kind of a spiritual woman.
Oh, no, my grandmother was murdered when my father was 11. So I had, you know, I never, ever saw her. I mean, clearly, he was 11. So it's more like missing my own grandmother, this grandmother who was murdered, wondering what she would have been like if she had lived. Who would she have been if she had been free? And so dedicating this book in that spirit, that this is a way to connect you to a granddaughter that you never even imagined, probably. But here I am, Grandmama, and I'm writing this book, and I'm dedicating it to you.
Well, I love the book, and I was reading it on the plane. I was on a trip, and I could hardly put it down, and I'm almost done, and I've only started, you know, I started in a few days and I just couldn't put it down. It's a fascinating book, and I really recommend it to anyone who's interested in the introspective. Mm-hmm. And the outwardly things too, the traveling and all of that. It's just great.
Well, thank you so much. You know, and I'm glad to hear you. You know, I don't know you, but you sound like just the kind of woman I was thinking of, because this is also a time of women's travel. Women getting on planes and ships and, you know, whatever, bicycles, and going there, you know, going there, going to the Amazon, you know, going to Iraq, going to wherever in the world, because finally, at last, we as women can do that. We can go and witness. We can go and see. We can see what's happening, and we can report back. And this is one of the major changes of the world.
And tell me where you have gone to witness. You have, in the not-too-distant past here, been going to Gaza. You've gone to other places in the world to witness. How do you choose what you will witness, Alice?
I think it chooses me. I find that I cannot. It's very much like a character. I sometimes write about characters only because they won't leave me. This happened with the woman in Possessing the Secret of Joy, who was genitally mutilated. She just wouldn't leave me alone until I wrote a novel that explored this whole issue. And the same is true with other places. I went to Gaza a little over a year ago, the first time. Actually, it was the only time, because they wouldn't let us in the second time. But I went there because my sister had died. I have an older sister who died, and I was in Mexico and she was in Atlanta, and I didn't go back for the funeral, but we did the ceremony for her in Mexico. And while we were doing this ceremony, which was really about 4 days long, the whole period while she was dying, Gaza was being bombed. And when I came out of this period, and also thinking that I probably wouldn't feel entirely devastated by my sister's death, since she'd been sick a long time, but then finding that I was devastated, I learned about this bombing, and I went to check on what was happening, and the first thing I saw was that 5 little girls in the same family had been killed, and their mother was unconscious. And I had this thought, which was, well, who's going to tell her? If she doesn't gain consciousness, who is going to tell her that, you know, she hadn't lost an aging older sister, she had lost her darling daughters. And so I hadn't planned to travel at all. I thought I would just stay there, you know, in my hammock, and but I ended up pretty soon going to Gaza, and I didn't meet this woman, but I met, you know, other women who had similar tragedies, and it was such a natural flow, you know, it was a real natural call on my heart. To just witness them, to be with them, and to try to understand what is happening in a way that is not, you know, kind of cartoonish. You know,
right.
We have a cartoonish notion of war and what it means, and, you know, war is not a cartoon.
No, it certainly isn't. So you were not allowed in the second time? Why was that?
Well, the second time, I had just come from India, which I love. I love India. And I love India partly because it has so many problems. Oh, but anyway, we got to Cairo, and the Egyptian government, which is basically, my sense is, controlled by the U.S. and Israel through the amount of aid that it gets, would not let us cross the one border that we had used before, the Rafah crossing, the Rafah border between Palestine and Egypt. And that was a trip too. Again, I had I think I had the flu, but I managed to go with one of the amazing women from Code Pink to petition the Red Crescent to let us through. There were 1,400 people from all over the world. I mean, just incredible people that make great sacrifices to get there, bringing $2 million worth of food and medicine and other things. And they would not let us go through. And finally, I think to save some kind of image of themselves, maybe, they let 65 people go out of 1,400. and I don't know how much of the aid, but not milk, because milk is a liquid, although the people are slowly starving to death. And it was just such a curious feeling to realize that there we were, all these people, you know, none of us all that, you know, well off that we could just take off this time to do this, begging, you know, really just begging to be permitted to give food and medicine to people who are starving and sick. It's a moment that is indelible in my mind, because it is so not right for people to have to beg to help other people.
Sure isn't right.
At the same time, what happened was I was coughing a lot, so I didn't say very much. And the Code Pink co-founder, who is Jody Evans, did all of the hard work there, of most of the begging. And I saw while she was doing this, you know, and none of us with any kind of support from any government, she represented the goddess. She represented that force in nature that persists in trying to bring good and peace and food and medicine, no matter what is happening.
Let's talk about women for a moment. You talk about women, this is our time to travel. There's also, and I can't remember at what time period this was written, that women need to have meetings with a group of women just to be in touch, to talk about what's going on in their lives, what their view of what's going on in the world, at least once a month. If you can't do it that often, every 2 months, et cetera. Do you do that, Alice, and why do you recommend that?
Okay, I've had a women's council that I've met with for 7 years. We're on break right now. And I've had a sangha for 10 years, meeting every month. And I think that our survival as a species probably hinges on whether we can begin to make circles. I think this is a kind of innate thing that, you know, creatures, including human creatures, have had to learn to do, or they have had it in themselves to do this. But to create circles, safe places where women or men or whoever, but I think women probably need to start with themselves, where you can discuss whatever is on your heart, you know, heavy on your heart or even light on your heart, but anyhow, to give an account of what you're seeing in the world and how you're impacting the world and how the world is impacting all of us. I think this is crucial. I don't see how we will survive in this separated fashion that we seem to cherish, which is that everybody's in his or her own little boat, and somehow, you know, you're going to manage to, I don't know, do what in your little boat. You need to have everybody on your mind as you're doing your work in the world, not just yourself.
This idea, and I'm wondering how you experience this. There are times when you move out of, when you have to be fairly solitary, I would think, to do your work. But this idea of a community, can you talk more about that, and how did that come, do you think, from naturally from your upbringing, being the youngest of eight children, and the way that you lived as a young person? You're joining other witnesses to things that are going on in the world. How should we be functioning in community? What does that word mean to you?
Well, more and more as a world community, which means that we can make our own communities open and friendly and free to all of the people who live in them, and we can stop as much as possible having communities that exclude other people. You know, it is such a, you know, it's such a sort of sorrow, really, that, for instance, in my growing up, you know, I encountered always the white communities that just did everything they could to make sure black people never moved into them, you know, bombing them and making fires out of their houses and all of those things, you know, just the desire to be separate and to be, you know, something else. But the short-sightedness of that is really so plain, because you can keep, you know, people of color out of your neighborhood, but you cannot keep out, you know, bad food and cancer and horrible indoctrination that your children, you know, absorb from television. So the lesson, I think, is that, you know, if you can get a community going in your town or in your area, you might be able to, you know, have nutritious things that come to you rather than things that are destructive. And you can only do that collectively, you know. And so I think the emphasis has to be on us as a collective now more than ever rather than as just single communities.
Are you still farming a great deal?
You know, I wrote a poem about how I call myself a farmer, but because that's my cat, she's scratching in her litter box.
Aww.
But anyway, I believe in growing my own food as much as I can. And wherever I am, I'm usually next to a bed of collard greens and kale and onions and whatever else I can grow. I think it's essential, and it's essential also because we must not forget that we actually live on the earth. We live with the earth. We live in the earth. We are the earth. I could never live in a high-rise, for instance, because I have that sense that if you are not connected on a daily basis really with the ground, it's very easy to forget, you know, who you are, really, as an earthling. It's easy to forget.
Is it a small thing that she's done, or do you think that it's a larger thing, the First Lady, to put this very beautiful garden in the White House? On the lawns.
Oh, I think it's a big thing. I haven't seen it. I haven't even seen a photograph. But I think it's a wonderful thing, and it's our tradition. It's our culture. I have never lived, without a garden. My mother never lived without a garden. My grandmother, my great-grandmother, it would just be unheard of. And I think for many Southerners, it is just shocking that people don't automatically try to grow their own food.
And if you would, please, a few comments on what seems to me to be a big thing in so many ways of having Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and the children front and center in America right now. I am still dumbfounded that he was elected.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Many of us are still just amazed. They are a medicine. I see them as medicine people. And in some ways, it's not even so much what they're doing. It's just the symbol of the medicine that they represent. They represent a major change in people's ability to grow and to also think much more deeply about their own survival. I think many people understood that if we had elected another Bush, for instance, chances are we just, you know, go down the tubes. And we may still go down the tubes, but we choose now to go down the tubes, if that happens, with people who, you know, have some good medicine and who really want to, you know, to keep us safe and happy and, you know, who work hard and who are good people. They're good people. I think for me, that's what's important. And, you know, when people say to me, what do you think your parents and grandparents would have thought about, you know, having a black president, I always say what they would have thought and wanted was a good person. Not so much, you know, a good president, because they had never experienced a good president. They never knew what a good president was. But they did know what a good person is and was, and that if you choose a good person to do something, chances are you'll get good results.
I think in one of the interviews with you, you were talking about what you try to accomplish in any given day, and I think your first response was that you try to be kind. I like that.
Yeah, well, kindness is I think, what will save us, kindness and caring. I think that if we just care about, you know, I on my blog, I have a blog, which I thought I would never have, but I actually love it. I posted something from a man who has a new theory about how to act in earthquakes, and he was he says that, you know, you should find that place near a sturdy object. When things fall down, there occurs a V, a little, it's like a triangle, a little space that's a triangle. And rather than ducking and covering, which is what we were taught, like going under a desk, we should find that place because things will fall down, but they won't fall. They'll be stopped by this object that we are crouched close to. So I considered his effort to enlighten us really helpful, although many people then immediately just jumped all over this man and said he was, you know, not telling useful information, da-da-da-da-da. But I thought that his caring, his trying to bring some new perspective was really encouraging. And so, you know, I thanked him for thinking about us in that moment. You know, somebody needs to think about us in that moment when the house is falling on our heads.
Right.
And often we feel that nobody is thinking about us in that moment. So caring and kindness are things that anybody can muster. It may take some doing some days when you feel, you know, like, oh, these people are all horrible. But you can still do it. I mean, and just think of it as a practice if you don't always feel it in your heart.
We welcome more phone calls for Alice Walker, or if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. You heard her mention her blog. We'll make sure that we give you a... Oh, I have to ask her why she likes doing the blog now, too. I'm that way with Facebook. I never thought I would like it, and I love it. So she didn't think she'd like a blog, and now she has one. We'll figure out where you can access that. We'll ask her that. And welcome more phone calls. Alice Walker is our guest this hour. The latest book is The World Has Changed. It's actually a series of very interesting conversations with Alice Walker. Interesting because what she has to say is worth listening to, but also interesting because it covers a long period of time from 1973 to 2009. She is an extraordinary writer of fiction and nonfiction. She is also a poet. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email address, if you'd like to send one of those our way, is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Alice Walker is our guest, and we go to more phone calls. Max is our next caller. Hi, Max.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
This lady is wonderful to listen to, and since she's witnessed so much of the world and its cultures, I wonder if she has an impression whether religion is overall a positive or a negative force in the world. Thank you, and I'll just listen.
All right, Max. Thank you.
I think because it has been patriarchal and male dominant, it has been really very, very bad. Although I was brought up, of course, as a Christian, my parents, grandparents, great-great-grandparents, the enslaved ones earlier on, were all indoctrinated, you know, as a way of controlling them. And making them not rebel against their, quote, masters. So when I look at the behavior of most of the religions toward women, I mean, that's the way you really tell. It's quite easy to see that it has been very harmful in most instances. And I know many people don't believe this because they, you know, they cling to what they've been taught. My own way is to accept from each religion those, you know, things that I think are wonderful. I love Jesus. I think he was a wonderful teacher. I don't think of him as my savior.
You call him the son of a feminist. He would have to have been the son of a feminist in one of the interviews.
Yeah, he would have to be the son of a feminist. You know, I would like to hear a lot more about Mary as she really was. But anyway, my own thinking is that religion is something you inherit. I mean, people inherit their religion, and then they think that they have to keep it. But like anything else you inherit, you don't. You don't have to keep what you inherit. You can just give it away or just let it go. It seems to me that the earthling journey, the journey of persons on the earth, is just, you know, t- tailor-made for us to find our own beliefs, and that is what I have done. So I feel very much an animist. I feel very much a pagan. I feel very much someone who adores nature. I just am astonished every single day by the wonder of this place. You know, the whole cosmos just seems to me miraculous, and that we managed to get here and to witness that. Talk about
true.
Witnessing. That's the miracle.
Isn't it something? Here we are.
And yeah, isn't it amazing?
It is amazing.
And then to think that, you know, people would limit you to any little, you know, book or any little thought is really, you know, it's hard to even imagine.
Alice, I know a lot of people have asked you this, but you do, and I want you to talk about the role of meditation in your life. Why don't you consider yourself a Buddhist?
Because Buddha didn't consider himself a Buddhist. You know, you don't. That's the whole point. You don't really need to latch on to anything and follow anybody and be, you know, a sort of derivative. You can be, you know, the thing itself, and that's the journey. I mean, the journey is not to just follow Buddha. The journey is to be that kind of being, you know, someone who, with an open heart, with compassion, and what that means is a lot of work, and that's why people would rather be a Buddhist than to be the actual Buddha, because, you know, they figure, well, the actual Buddha can do the work, and I can get the credit. But, I don't really need a label. You know, I will say, you know, pagan, animist, just to bring those words back into usage and recognition so people can say, oh, yeah, well, maybe everything does have spirit. You know, maybe, you know, I'm cutting down this tree and maybe it has an opinion. You know, maybe it's really, I'm cutting down, you know, myself in some other incarnation. So it's helpful to have the terms and, you know, to sort of contemplate. But basically, you know, in my writing, for instance, I really think of it. People look at all my books and they go, oh, you must never do anything but write. But that's not true at all. The writing is just like fruiting. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm looking now at a grapefruit tree outside my window.
Oh.
And it's just full of grapefruit. And I just, it just happens, you know. That's what it does. And I write books in the same way.
Hmm. Let's go to Ruth from Milwaukee. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Great.
Good.
I have a question for Alice. I have a 14-year-old daughter. I'm 52. And when I was in college, I took Women's Lit and read Meridian and, of course, Color Purple. And I have let my daughter read Color Purple, and I was kind of shocked when she told me about it because I'd forgotten some of the sexual details. And I do remember the sexual details of Meridian, and I was just wondering what you think of letting someone so young read your early literature.
How old was she?
14 right now.
Oh, and she read it before then?
She read The Color Purple when she was 12.
Yeah.
I had just forgotten.
I think,
and, you know, she dealt with it pretty well.
I think we know our children, and some of our children are ready and some of our children are not. And I used to talk to parents. You know, I was thinking about putting a little notice in some of my books about, you know, being very careful about introducing some of the ideas and some of the themes, because, you know, some of the things that I think you're just saying, they're sexual things. Actually, they're not really that sexual. They're about violence. They're about sexual violence. You know, the rape of Celie by her stepfather, you know, early on in that book. My own mother, and she was, you know, I don't know, 70 or something, was appalled. She couldn't handle it because it. I think in her case, it brought up a lot of memories of how vulnerable young black girls, especially in the South, had been to black men and white men when she was growing up. I mean, her one of her stories was how the way she escaped rape was by being very strong and running. You know, that she had a very good running ability. So you just have to, you know, decide and sit with your children and see if they're ready for these things. I don't know, you know, your daughter. So I bless her and I hope that she's okay.
Yeah, well, we live in the city, and sometimes she walks through, you know, marginal neighborhoods, and she does. She is a track person, and she does run, and we do want her to be strong and not to live a scared life. And I think your advice, I'm in my heart, it's telling me, yeah, let her read it and let her become exposed, and maybe it'll make her stronger and feel more connected.
Well, and also remember that the marginal world that she's walking through is what the world is becoming more and more. So maybe not your neighborhood, you know, and that's good, but the world itself, part of the problem of the gadgetizing of the world is that everybody is looking at something that is inanimate, that represents the world, but the real world is being stolen, and it's being trashed. And so when you then leave your neighborhood, you know, and go to many other places in the world, you find the margin. You know, that's what you find. That's what's happening. I remember I was in the Amazon once, and we went for, you know, like, I don't know, a long, 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 long dugout canoe ride up the river, and just, you know, mile after mile, nothing but deforested banks. You know, the forest had been cut down. This was the margin, you know, this is where. And it was completely lawless. You could feel that. The women were terrified. There was a woman who needed to go somewhere in our boat, and she was so beaten down and afraid of everything that she thought that we wouldn't even want her to sit near us. So she was, like, clinging to the back of the boat.
Oh.
So I think that, in a way, you know, maybe not 12 years old, but I think early on when our children begin to mature, it is helpful to let them know what is happening, you know, in places that we consider the margin, because the margin is just getting much bigger.
Right. Thank you so much for the call. Why do you love the blog?
Well, I like the immediacy of it, and I like it because I don't charge anything. I mean, I always want this image I have of myself as a tree in flower and in fruit is the freedom of that. It, you know, nature loves to give. You know, it is just always doing that. And I like, you know, when you, I mean, I have to make a living, of course, and I've had to, you know, in my early years really work very hard and try to sell things at a good price and all that. But now, for a while anyhow, I like the feeling of just writing something, sending it out there. It's free. You know, it's just like the grapefruit dropping.
That's good.
How do
we get it, Alice? How do you get to your blog?
Well, here's a funny thing. It's Alice Walker Blog.
Okay. So you just Google that.
But I also have a website, which is Alice Walker's Gardens.
Okay.
And the reason it's called that is that my mother was an artist, but her only palette was her garden.
And
it was a spectacular garden.
Oh.
And I got to see what a real artist looks like when she is just transformed by the passion of what she's doing. And so I encourage all women to, and men too, to find that garden. You know, if you ever witness it in anyone, not just your parent, but if you ever witness someone in the garden of their creativity, you know, the bliss that is so apparent is something that we should aim for in our own lives, because, you know, they show us that it's real.
They certainly do. Dr. Martin, we have about a minute left here. You spent some time talking about Dr. Martin Luther King, and I know that you were there was a press clipping about your being at a bookstore in which you were talking about walking with Dr. Martin Luther King, bugging him to death,
I didn't say that.
Oh, you didn't say that?
I'm going to today write to whoever that was.
Okay, good.
Tell them, because it's so ridiculous. But I think it's something that we have to pay attention to, way that I think this was a young person, and I don't think they were taught that when you put quotation marks around what people say, it means verbatim. It means that you're quoting them verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just completely not my voice, not my words.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we even talked about bugging people in the way that this writer means. We talked about being bugged, you know, know, Martin Luther King was bugged
sure.
by the FBI.
Right.
And that is because Hoover wanted to, what's his name, Hoover? Anyway, the guy who was the
J. Edgar.
J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah.
You know, wanted to basically destroy him. But that was the kind of bug that we talked about. We didn't talk about bugging people and bothering them.
What an important figure he was. He's taught to be simplistic in some ways now, a very complicated man who risked his life. He risked his life.
But he's only thought about in those terms that he would be simplistic by people who have never read him and
right.
don't understand. It's the same with Gandhi. I mean, mm-hmm. both of those men are incredibly complicated.
Yeah.
And really intense.
So are you, and that's good. Thanks, Alice. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alice Walker. The book is The World Has Changed, Conversations with Alice Walker, series of interviews from 1973 all the way to 2009. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program, Chrissy Pease for on-air production.